Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Success isn't a goal, it's a journey. I interview the most incredible humans to keep your mind optimized for growth. Hello and welcome to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today, we have an amazing show lined up. I have the founder of Shazam, Dheeraj Mukherjee, and this is probably one of the most used apps on my phone, so I was pretty excited to say the least, and I just remember it coming out and it just being a completely mind-blowing piece of technology. But the actual story behind the business is even more exciting. For years before most people ever heard of it, they were working on it and they've just had so many ups and downs and difficulties that they encountered that it's just a huge insight to actually hear the full story, and I'm really grateful to be able to share this with you. So, as I said, Dheeraj will share with us the whole story of how he built the business and his partners and taking it from an idea between them when none of them could even code to just turning the whole thing into a reality and then actually being able to like grow the business and exit and just all the trials and tribulations along the way. It's a really inspiring story with tons of lessons, an episode that you don't want to miss, and I would definitely be sharing with people a lot. So yes, enjoy. And with that, let's jump into the episode. Welcome to another episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we have Dheeraj Mukherjee. Also, background announced pronunciation work was not fulfilled. I was listening, but it was quite a few months ago when we first started talking, when I kind of worked out how to say your name, and now I've forgotten. So apologies if I messed that up.
I say Dheeraj.
Dheeraj Mukherjee.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's okay. I get called all kinds of things, so I don't mind.
Pleased to hear that. Well, I'm sorry that you get called all kinds of things, but I'm pleased to hear that you take it in a very chill manner. And it sounds like you're a warm, lovely person. So I'm looking forward to the rest of the conversation. So you were one of the original founders of Shazam. And that's just an amazing story that most people with a phone who vaguely like music will know about you. And I certainly remember the moment I first heard of Shazam and just like that, what the mind-blowing hell is going on? My phone has just turned into this wizard device and I've had it ever since. And very impressive what you did. And since then, you've got into just angel investing and helping businesses who are doing like tech for good and building like communities and benefiting the world. So you're a very interesting person who is certainly very welcome on the show.
Thank you so much.
No worries. And so firstly, I mean, I've glossed over what you've done, but would you like to just give us like a quick 3-minute intro to sort of like your life? Okay, where did you come from? Like school, what got you interested in like entrepreneurialism, etc.?
Sure. So I'm from India. My dad used to work for Air India. So I grew up all over the place in France and Switzerland and Singapore and Japan. So it was a big kind of hodgepodge in terms of family background. And I ended up in the United States for university. I was at Dartmouth College on the East Coast and ended up working for Bain, which is a strategy consulting firm. So I didn't have any entrepreneurial background as such, but I just wanted to go to business school where the sun shines in California. So I ended up at Stanford in 1995, which was just when the internet was starting up, and all around there was a huge buzz of excitement about this new technology and all the opportunities, and everyone and their dog wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I just jumped on that bandwagon, and that's how I ended up being an entrepreneur.
Nice. I've literally just been writing a blog around how where you go to uni and like where you're around sort of affects the rest of your life, and if you're around people that are kind of getting into something, you're sort of probably going to be in that area versus something else. Complete tangent, let's not go down that. Interesting though, would quite like to know a bit more about like that whole area, I guess, because I wasn't around Stanford in 1995, but I've read lots about it. This sounds like a really fascinating place. Did you just really want to go there in the first place because you knew what was going on, or was it kind of like a bit of an accident that you thought it would be good and then you got there and it was like, oh my God, all this stuff?
Yeah, it was an accident. I was just looking forward to being in an environment which was the California dream. I remember listening to the Mamas and the Papas, that song, California Dreaming, before I moved out there. I didn't really have any idea that I'd end up in Silicon Valley at the time when the internet was just literally being born. And for your younger listeners who won't remember all the way back to 1995 or whatever, it was a time of radical change. There was talk about the end of the business cycle and the long boom. And actually what happened was the boom lasted 5 years and then there was a terrible bust in 2000. So the dreamers were proven to be wrong. But there's always a context and a time and a place. And in the late 90s in Silicon Valley, it was all about how big could you dream, how large could you scale, how big could you go. So that was the environment, and all the conversations were about your latest idea and partnering and trying to find the right people to work with. So now looking back in 2020, I've learned a lot along the way, but that might give you a little bit of a background for what it felt like back then.
Cool. Certainly sounds like a really, really exciting place to be. And I mean, I was 5 at the time. So, you know, when you're really young and you don't really appreciate anything that's changing, you kind of just think it's constant. And around like 2000, my dad was involved in a lot of like millennium bug stuff. And that's when I started kind of getting a bit aware of like the world and things. But yeah, that sounds really, really interesting. And I guess like, and you know, like now, it sort of does feel like there's lots of change going on. And you feel like, oh, the world's going to be so different compared to like what it was, which I guess it is. But also you kind of forget like how much things have always been changing in that sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. Silicon Valley still is unique in terms of the concentration of engineers and venture capitalists and dreamers and PR people helping companies go big. But I see a lot more entrepreneurial ecosystems all around the world, and certainly here in London and the UK, there's a really strong one, and around the world really. So when we started Shazam in 2000, it was still sort of a fringe occupation or a fringe career, and it's not the case at all. I think being an entrepreneur today, there's a lot more kind of support systems and fellow travelers around.
Yeah, it'd be quite nice to actually sort of go into starting a company like Shazam. Just sounds like another kind of, okay, starting a startup that's tech that goes really well. But actually, back then, it is a really odd thing to be doing. It's like people started normal businesses, but it still wasn't. Whereas like now, like I'm on Techstars. There's Techstars things all over the planet. There's so many other accelerators. There's just like so much stuff for us. So what help did you have? Was it just like, okay, you guys wanted to start a tech business? There are somewhere you went. Like, how did it come about?
Yeah, so the story is that my business partner, Chris, was a very good friend, and we would go out and have beers and talk about, you know, starting a company. And he was at Berkeley Business School at the time, and he had a buddy called Philippe, and they used to study together, and they had promised each other they'd start a business. Looking for ideas, Chris and I happened to end up in London in the summer of 1998, I believe it was. And we would just spend time trying to come up with something which we could throw ourselves into. And Chris came up with the idea for Shazam, because we would hear music when we were out and about and we didn't know what it was. And his original idea was, if you could tap into radio stations and work out based on the radio station and the time what song you were listening to, then that would, you know, scratch that particular itch. And he was thinking about what would be better than that. And as he thought about it, he thought, hey, if you could use your mobile phone to identify any song, not just on the radio, it could be in a bar or club or pub, then that would kill that radio idea. And that's how the idea for Shazam was born. The problem is, it was, by the way, the first good idea that we had. Everything else was rubbish. And the problem was that we were not technical. We were 3 MBAs. We didn't have any engineers on the team. We didn't know the first thing about the science involved. We were so clueless, we didn't even know what domain of science it was, let alone, you know, how to get started. And then there's a whole bunch of other challenges around getting hold of the music that we wanted to identify. So we were like in startup kindergarten.
Yeah, wow, interesting. Because I had the idea for my current tech business, I think like 8 years ago, but I wasn't technical and I was running a different business anyway, which was kind of like Deliveroo, but I ended up selling it because I couldn't take it to the next step because I wasn't technical and didn't really have the confidence back then as like a 20-year-old to really sort of raise investment and sort of pay a bunch of people to do this idea. This is like a next level tech idea that you've got. How could you even validate that it was possible and like know who to pay? And there's lots of questions I'm sure you can kind of unpack.
Yeah, luckily Google had been invented a couple of years before. At the time, the big search engines were things like Ask Jeeves, for instance. So we just set about like researching, like trying to find out what we needed to do next. I remember researching like the microphones of mobile devices to work out were they going to be fit for purpose. As it happens, we discovered that the science was digital signal processing. And by a stroke of luck, the experts in the field happened to be at Stanford and at Berkeley. And Chris and Philippe were finishing up their MBA, so they were in the right place at the right time. And they just started talking to experts and they described the problem to them. And the problem was, we're trying to record 15 seconds of sound over the microphone of a mobile handset. At the time, it was Nokias. These were not smartphones at all. And then transmit that sound over a GSM network or mobile network and match it against 1 million songs, which was roughly the number of tracks which were available if you looked in the biggest record shop on Oxford Street at the time. And we needed to match that with high accuracy, fast enough so that the user wasn't waiting for 6 hours, and let the user know the name of the song and the artist, but all of this at an economic cost so we could build a big business and live the dream. Now, the people we spoke to, who were for the most part guys with PhDs, then like, you guys are nuts. It can't be done. You know, it's not within the known science. But my business partners don't take no for an answer very well. So they kept pounding the pavement, knocking on doors, asking people, and eventually spoke to Professor Julia Smith, who is the head of Stanford's Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics. And Dr. Smith had developed technology, for instance, which could identify the sound of a submarine in the water just by the noise of the propeller, which was not audible to the human ear. So he felt that if that was achievable, then this music recognition idea we'd come up with should be feasible. And so Chris and Philippe asked him, they said, who is the best PhD student that you've worked with in the last 25 years? And Professor Smith said, Dr. Avery Wang. And we still have a piece of paper where they wrote that name down and circled it five times. And they hunted down Dr. Avery Wang and brought him on board as our fourth co-founder.
Well, how did the conversation with Avery go? Like, okay, we want to do this nuts thing. You can like build it, become a co-founder. Was it super simple of like, they were up for that?
No, not at all. So they emailed him. He read the email, said that these are a couple of nutters and just deleted it. So because they don't take no for an answer, then they emailed Professor Smith and then got an introduction. So this time Avery met with him and they explained the situation to him. And Avery started thinking about it. All the other experts had thrown them out. But because Avery started applying his mind to it, they knew he was the man. So they basically twisted his arm until he yielded and decided to join us just because of the challenge as much as anything else, and promptly found himself locked in his basement. And we said, look, you know, time is tight. How about 3 months? If you can invent this, you know, breakthrough technology, that would be awesome. So we can get on with this startup thing.
Wow. It's a good timeline. That's awesome. Amazing. So at that point, had you raised any money or like got anything involved with it? Just like an idea, like you guys are sort of doing other things, but like this is just like your side project? And
no, it was an idea, and we were really good at churning out PowerPoint. So we had all kinds of pretty pictures and curves which went like this with the revenues and profit margins, which were astronomical. And we'd go around to investors and try to pitch the idea. And the investors would say, look, you guys are nuts. We need to see some technology here. So it put the pressure back on Avery. And poor Avery spent about 3 months trying his best and realized that he was just not going to be able to solve this problem. And he felt bad because his business partners were running around. I had registered the company. We had done a massive financial model. We had generated stacks of slides. And he was in a cafe in Palo Alto, basically rehearsing his speech to tell us that he was giving up. And when he was there, he had a breakthrough. He was just mulling this over and he went back to his lab and tried it. And amazingly, bingo, he was able to find a breakthrough to this really, really complicated problem. And we were able to put a demo together. And in the summer of 2000, we raised $1 million on the back of the idea and the demo.
Wow. That's amazing to see like him getting to the point where he sort of was actually writing why. It's really funny as a programmer myself, sort of, you'll often be really stuck on a problem and it won't be until you ask someone for help that you'll actually solve it whilst you're asking them. You'll like say like, oh, if I just did it this way, it would be fine. And you're like, oh, I guess I should just do it that way. Sorry for wasting your time. I'll move on. And you just kind of like light yourself up lots of things. It's really strange phenomenon. So, I mean, I'm not sure what happened to him exactly, but maybe he was being like, oh, it'll never work because we haven't done this. And then, like, well, I can't read what he'd written.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to get into Avery's mind because it's this sort of universe of complicated mathematical things. He's just an off the charts genius, but very down to earth. And what he achieved is remarkable. And so that was really the foundation for us being able to make the idea come to life.
It's really hard to convince people of things to give you money until the point where you suddenly have like some proof, which has been a thing that we've been experiencing. But then you said this before, smartphones and things. So I think most people know about you from when they got like the app and such. So how did you actually start then, if this was before apps or anything?
Yeah, so the way it worked was it was an IVR system. So it was just a normal phone call and users in the UK would dial a number, which was 2580, which is the 4 digits straight down the middle of your mobile. You hold your phone up and after 15 seconds, Shazam would hang up on the call and you'd get a text message with the name of the song and the artist. So that's how it worked in the pre-smartphone days, which had all kinds of problems because people would forget the number and they'd start punching around and couldn't remember, or the text message would go missing. They'd swear at us. And it was the best we could do at the time. But yeah, things got much better once smartphones came along.
At the point when you then like received investment, was it just like super relieving? Was it like super stressful? Like, crap, we've got to actually sort of make this thing into like a huge business now. What was your like initial like feelings?
The first 3 or 4 months, we had the wind in our sails. classes because it was still the boom time. And we went out and we hunted down these amazing angels who were either experts in the music business or in the mobile domain or these technologies sort of like pioneers. We did the pitch, we took their checks, we banked it, and we had a great time. And we felt that we were living the dream. In the summer of 2000, things changed because that's when the internet bubble burst. And what happened was that the NASDAQ index came down by about 70%. Investors realized that they were just throwing their money behind all these ideas, which were never going to make it. And then the environment became really tough. And what was even worse than that was in September 2001 was the Twin Towers attack, and that put a further damper on business. So there's a giant contraction of the economy. Funding for startups just dried up. There were dead startups left, right, and center. And we were there stuck. We had left our jobs. My old company went bust a year after I left. So there was no going back. We had raised this money. We had hired the team. The only way was forward. And that's when we realized, oh my goodness, this is not just fun and games anymore.
Yeah, sounds like a bit of a scary moment of being... Yeah. I mean, super awesome to be working on something you would love, but that also kind of scary that this is like everything you're working for. How do you feel around how serious to take it like when you're doing things? Because I kind of flip between like being stressed out by stuff and sort of being like, this is the most important thing or whatever, to like, oh, life, it doesn't really matter. The worst case scenario is like it all goes wrong. And that's not actually that bad. So it's kind of confusing. Did you kind of feel that you were able to stay level, or was it really deeply stressful?
I think that we managed to find the balance just because we really enjoyed being around each other. And, you know, we used to joke around, and our lives were sort of like work hard during the day and then go out with our teammates at night. And we hired friends and family, for instance, people I'd worked with before. One of our early employees was my cousin. So we were literally like this little bubble of family and friends, you know, trapped in this terrible storm, which was destroying the would-be entrepreneurs. And, you know, we did our best. I'm not going to say it wasn't stressful, but it was positive stress. We did whatever we could to get the money that we needed, whatever we could to hire the people so we could, you know, bring this to market. Because we knew that if we had to switch the lights off, it would be our closest friends we'd be, you know, letting go. And so it was definitely not a walk in the park, but we tried our best to keep moving forward, keep making things happen.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I personally get stressed out when I don't have stress. If that makes sense, as in that I kind of like to have a sort of the momentum of doing things like slightly outside of my comfort zone and always sort of challenging. And it means that you kind of constantly have a reason to like work a bit later or try harder and do more. And on the subject of stress, you mentioned like it was hard to get people to remember the number and these things and like everything was just quite difficult before apps. I don't know what your vision of the future was like, that there would be smartphones soon and that like it would be easy for things to be. So I don't know if you planned for that in the long run, or was it like, okay, we're always just going to have the technology like this as far as you're aware? And was it difficult to get traction just the way that you were doing it to start with?
Yeah, so the mobile phone was relatively new. They've been around for 4 or 5 years. There wasn't mass adoption yet, but we could see that it would become a commonplace device. And I remember reading a report which was, you know, 300 pages on the future of the mobile. So we could look ahead and anticipate what the smartphone might do. It was the really early days of being able to access the internet on your phone, which was really slow and clunky and, you know, didn't work 95% of the time. What we didn't know was how long it would take, and it took much longer than we had expected. And what we didn't anticipate was the app store and the advent of the apps, which today we more or less take for granted. So to a certain extent, we were kind of placing a bet on smartphones and the ubiquity of being able to access information. But the service at launch, we knew was going to be a very simple kind of service. It was the best we could do at the time. And even the text message with the name of the song and the artist, that was a billing mechanism. Text messages were not that common. And the reverse charge text message, which basically charged the customer for receiving the information and then we'd get a slice of the revenue, was brand new.
Cool. That's kind of exciting. But yes, it's a very interesting bet to be placing around. It's quite difficult with investors. They're always sort of trying to make sure that it's the right time for the idea. And there's a good TED speech around like the most important thing in a business, and it's sort of, it's not necessarily the founders or the idea. It's like the actual timing of the idea, which sounds like you kind of nailed it, but perhaps if you'd been like a year or maybe two later, it could also have been okay, just that you were sort of the first one at the advent of smartphones to really able to grow up.
So we started the company in 2000. We did a VC round, which was £5.3 million in 2001. And then we launched in 2002, which was, you know, a really, really bad time for then raising additional funding, which we had to do because we were losing cash every second of every minute of every day, just because of the costs of fingerprinting the music that we were working with, running the team, being able to do some marketing to get the word out. And so we did a couple of other rounds in 2004 and 2005, if memory serves me right. But it was only in 2008 when the App Store launched that the user experience changed enough for it to become viable as a business. So we had the advantage of being in the market and learning from our mistakes and working out what it took to actually grow this business. But it was a long and lonely, scary time for several years.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds kind of stressful. Definitely. It's amazing that you managed to keep on raising money and things if it were technically wasn't sort of making unit economics, because you kind of feel that people always wanted to be making it work like now.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, times were so desperate because we were always a business to consumer service, but we realized that the technology could be used for other things. So for instance, monitoring what was being played on the radio so that artists could get paid. And it got to the point where we actually sold our core technology to a third party in the US who would use it for a B2B service. And that's what kept the company alive. Otherwise, we would have gone bust in 2005. And we were lucky enough, because we survived, that once the iPhone launched and we were able to, you know, grow our core business, that we bought back the technology portfolio. But it was literally like pawning the family jewels and just trying to survive on noodles until we could, you know, make some money and buy them back.
That's amazing. And also really interesting around sort of having like the B2C play, which is kind of what I've got going on, but like being able to find sort of B2B aspects of that to actually sort of keep the lights on, because it does seem like generally a lot easier to get investment in B2B because people, you can see that, okay, I know who the person is going to give the money and like if it will work. Whereas with B2C, you kind of just rely on somehow reaching scale after some magic has happened with product market fit, which often doesn't happen. So I was having a discussion with my co-founders yesterday around like at what point we'd start paying ourselves more and these kind of things. So after you raise a million, that sounds like a lot of money. Can you kind of tell me about at what levels you paid yourself along with the different rounds of how much money you raised? Because after like raising 5 million, we're like, okay, well, we'll probably be on like 100 grand each because of it. It seems a bit weird if we're not, but would that be a bad, I don't know. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
I lived quite a frugal lifestyle because I believe that as an entrepreneur, you've got to literally watch every pound. And so I had some savings and lived a really simple life. So we paid ourselves £1,000 a month when we started off. And then when we got to the venture round and we raised the 5.3 million, then we went back to a more sort of like normal salary. I think it was £85,000. And so there was a sharp intake of breath. They're like, wow, that's pretty rich and we need to feed ourselves. So we got part of that in cash and part of it in equity. But I do think that it's a mental discipline about, you know, being able to be frugal both personally as well as for the business, and to treasure every pound, which is whether it's in the bank or whether it's to be collected or whether it's from an investor, because otherwise sometimes one can just fail to make it if one doesn't look after those. And I guess in the long run, financial stress is no good at all. But my advice to entrepreneurs, and what I look for in entrepreneurs, is the ones who are like really careful, because it's the lifeblood of a business. And more often than not, you'll find that you're short of cash rather than have plenty of cash. So it helps to have that mindset, in my view.
Thanks. I literally paid myself for the first time this month after not having a job for a year and a half, which was fun. And yeah, generally try to be kind of frugal with things, but also not too frugal, because it's kind of confusing, as in like you do need to spend money to make money, which is why VCs give you money in the first place. And you don't want to waste time as such by not spending enough money. And it's a really interesting act to play. Yeah, and also like the hiring decisions are like, okay, maybe you really like someone and you'd love to give them the opportunity, but can you afford to give them the opportunity, which is where I'm now stuck, as in we actually have to let our first person go, which is really sad. And it's definitely a lot of lessons there. Did you have many issues with hiring as you were going along, or in like hiring the wrong people and having to fire people?
We had a fantastic recruiter and we had to build the team really quickly. So we were up to 70 people by the time we launched. So we hired lots and lots of people. We were lucky because the core was friends and family. So people we had, you know, worked with before and worked alongside. And that helped to set the culture as well as a quality bar. But we made mistakes, and letting people go is always tough. What was really tough as well is we had a couple of rounds of layoffs just because we didn't have enough investment. And that's when we let people go who we really wanted to keep, including some really close personal friends who went through a very difficult time. It was not a good time to be without a job. The bottom line is that, you know, one is going to make mistakes and it's always difficult to know. But for us, what we tried to do was to always keep the quality bar as high as possible, because if you've got quality around you, then that makes a really big difference. And we tried our best to tell the best story possible to investors, to keep them on board, to keep those checks flowing so we could keep building that business. So we tried our best not to compromise on quality. And I'm still good friends with many people that I worked with 20 years ago who are amazing and brilliant and interesting and went on to fantastic careers after Shazam as well. And I look back and I think there's no way we would have made it without those people. We were in a really fortunate position because times were so tough that we got some fantastic people at you know, great salaries, and that carried us through the tough times.
Yeah, that's cool.
You may have heard about Feels CBD, but let me tell you why I love it. It's a great and natural way to relieve chronic pain, stress, and anxiety. It's a premium CBD delivered direct to your door, and it's easy to take with a few drops under the tongue and you're good to go. And as a full-time CEO of a cash-strapped startup, I'm trying to do a million things at once, and I experience a good level of stress every day, and Feels helps me ride the waves, getting regular sleep, which I think is the most important thing to just keep your sanity and your health in check. So Feels helps you just have a natural night of sleep and wake up feeling great. They have a support hotline with real humans, and remember that it does work naturally with no high or hangover or addiction. You can join their membership to save money on every order, and if you sign up now at feels.com/growth, you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. Now that's Feels, which is feals.com/growth, to become a member now with 50% off and free shipping. Feels.com/growth.
So one thing is, like, okay, how did you scale up to 70 people so fast without things going wrong on, like, culture? You spoke about, like, actually getting the right people, but just and managing, because of even getting the team to 8 people, I've been just learning so much around making sure everyone, like, is working from the same page and knows what they're doing, etc. So yeah, can you elaborate?
So after business school, I joined an internet consulting firm called Viant, which was based in San Francisco. When I joined, they had 100 employees, and we were helping big companies build digital businesses on the internet. So work out what their strategy was going to be, come up with an idea, you know, build it, launch it, and grow it. With that company, we went from 100 employees to 1,000 in the space of 3 years. So it was real hypergrowth. And what I learned from that is, how do you scale a business? How do you scale an operation? And it's about coming up with processes which make sense and which can be replicated, so everybody knows exactly what they're doing. And that experience helped me to think about and build the same kinds of processes. And we borrowed those methods, which is, how do you interview at scale and build consensus so the people involved in the interview process have a similar criteria, a process which everyone understands, it's collaborative, and then when you get a candidate, then they are bought into the culture and the way we do things. And what's amazing is that even now, I use those skills and those learnings from 20 years ago. Unfortunately, Viant didn't make it, because once the internet boom fell off the cliff, they just weren't able to keep the business alive. So even very successful, fantastic people can have that moment where you just hit the roadblocks and you just don't make it. So fortunate to be here to tell you the story of Shazam, but there's so many things which could have gone wrong, and we'd be a footnote in history. But that was where we got some of the thoughts about scaling, having been through it and seen it a Silicon Valley style before we started Shazam.
Cool. So I guess one question that you always like is, actually, could you remember, like, what was the worst sort of moment where you sort of thought, oh, everything's going to fail, we're never going to make it, like, we're going to run out of money, or you're going to get sued? Was there, like, a really low time at some point?
Yeah, I think the worst time was when, at one point, we had one of our major investors pull out, and they just got cold feet. They had made commitments which were in tranches, and they said, we can't follow through because you haven't hit the milestones. And so we had to have a round of forced layoffs where it turned into this really ugly scene where we had to take people into the office and tell them that, I'm sorry, you don't have a job. That was not our culture. That was not how we operate as people. That's not how we like to treat the people we worked along. But we had no option, so that, let's say, that the code needed to be secured if we were letting someone go. That was the worst moment by far, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But the reality is that any entrepreneur, if you're in this game, you're going to go through those dark points and you've got to take it on the chin. So I've learned from those, and there were many other experiences as well, where investors were extremely stressed as well. And we'd be in the boardroom and trying to explain to them why we felt that we could keep going. And they were understandably agitated about the future of the business. But I think if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Here I am.
Yeah, I understand the good mentality. Do you feel like in some ways it was possibly good for the business, like something good came out of doing that? Or would that be a hard one to explain?
I definitely think that business which goes through the pain which we did early on is much more resilient. So when you're in a survival situation, that builds your character. And that I would wish on the generation of entrepreneurs such as yourself, having survived this year and looking to next year, which is also full of uncertainty. I think the mental habits and the mindset that creates can only be helpful throughout the life of the business. I'm not saying no pain, no gain, but that pain can definitely be constructive.
Yeah. And I really felt that way, as in both businesses and like my actual personal like body. I've nearly died a few times, and it's really changed my perspective on the world, which I've really enjoyed. Like in the moment, maybe the business side I didn't like so much, but it's kind of got to the point where I kind of get excited when everything's going wrong, because I'm like, I know it's going to work out, and whatever's wrong is not forever, and that I'm going to be learning things. So I almost like don't feel as much of the pain that's there, because it's kind of already acknowledging that there'll be benefits as well at the same time. So I'm kind of just like trying to sort of just think on about that bit, which has been really helpful.
That's right. And the world doesn't stand still. You know, it changes so much. There's so many sort of opportunities which emerge from a world of pain. So I think 2020 has been a very painful year, but lots of good things are coming out of it. And having kind of endured that and survived it, then I think it just kind of opens minds to possibilities. And what might have been a survival strategy then becomes a new business, for instance, you know. So yeah, I definitely believe that being able to ride it out is invaluable.
Yeah, 100% agreed. Cool. Okay, so the point where like mobile phones come out and like the iPhone, was it like, oh my God, this is perfect? Was that the point where investors were sort of finally a little bit less scared about things and things took off? Or
one of the most exciting moments, I guess, was when the App Store had launched and Shazam, the brand new shiny app, was available for download. And then Apple did a bunch of advertising because users didn't know what an app was. They said, hey, for example, you can use your phone to identify music. And customers were like, really? They're like, yep. Well, they didn't say that, but the ad explained that you could use your mobile to do that. And then the app was climbing and climbing in the charts, and it made it to number 2, which was this incredible moment. But we're like, this is it. The world really gets what we were trying to do. From that point to the point we exited the business took another 10 years. So overnight success definitely didn't work out for us. But so there was lots and lots of adventures and misadventures from that kind of that moment. But the reality is that once the word spread and once people started using it, it felt like a lot of that pressure was eased, and we could now start seeing going up rather than head down, like trudging through treacle, you know. So yeah,
so I guess you felt more like in the right place at the right time, and that, or like at least other people recognize that. Maybe
I think it's more that we found the platform which could then build the word of mouth, which we had always envisaged. We just didn't have the deep pockets to do the marketing. And we had this idea in our head that would be like this magical moment where you go, what is that sound? Oh, this is really annoying me. And then you find out and you go, ah, I feel so much better. So we were able to, you know, spread that little moment of magic to many more people. And then they could tell their friends and share the experience, etc. So it was our own pain. We're like, what is that song? And being able to make that pain go away. As an aside, there's a TV show called Beaches, which was being filmed in Hollywood a couple of years ago, where they had contestants and you've got to try to beat the machine. And they had scouted and found these people all over the country who were brilliant at music. And they'd play like an obscure little bit of a song, and within 2 seconds, you know, the teams would nail it. And Chris and I are sitting there in the audience looking at each other going, what's that song? I don't know. You tell me. Nothing had changed. We were still as useless as before.
Yeah, that's really funny. Like, I mean, I mean, if you're, well, there's some songs that you barely need like anything at all, and you can kind of know exactly what it is. It's quite interesting the way the brain works with memory and stuff.
That's right.
And just the whole machine learning and how you can get that to like replicate different brain processes in some ways or other. Yeah, that's quite fascinating. Now, how did you feel? So, you know, like when you first started it, it's like this sort of crazy idea to someone that's just sort of like hard to be taken seriously, to the point now where like, you know, people are making TV shows. It's sort of one of the most well-known apps on the planet. And what's your concept of yourself?
Yeah, it's a little crazy, to be honest with you, because obviously I could relate to the problem and I have the need, but it happens to me maybe once a month or so. But, you know, there's lots and lots of people who use Shazam on a weekly basis, for instance. So I think even though we dreamt big, I couldn't have imagined that it would be something which so many people would relate to. And I guess that from my perspective, it's a privilege. I mean, the thing which people say to me the most, they say, oh, Shazam, I've got it on my phone. So there's a personal connection, you know, and it's more than I could have dreamt. My kids use it. My kids' friends use it. It's fantastic. But the reality is that it's not something which doesn't help to save the planet. So I take the opportunity to be able to invest my time, or in some cases, my money, to help, you know, entrepreneurs who are going through this ups and downs, which I'm very familiar with, but to do something which kind of gives back and adds value to society. So yeah, it's a huge privilege, which I don't take for granted.
That's really nice to hear. Yeah, because I just like that kind of identity thing. It's like, it's a bit funny one, like as a CEO, is I'm trying to take myself seriously and talk about things, but we've been talking about like certain office policies and stuff as if we're like 3 years down the line and raise tons of money. It's like, well, you know, come on, which is like a team of eight people, we all know each other, like which is a bunch of mates, we don't need to maybe be so serious about stuff. And when you got into that area, how do you go around screening for like investments then? Is it just you go to like accelerators? Do you have some kind of like VC official arm or something? What's like the actual process?
I'm very open about this with the entrepreneurs. I tend to learn more from them than they learn from me. So I come across entrepreneurs, it could be at a networking event, it could be through, you know, mentoring at accelerators. And I look for entrepreneurs who remind me of my early days. So the ones who won't take no for an answer, who will really do whatever it takes to make things happen. And I feel like if I can just be a shoulder to cry on once in a while, or point out something which they may not be aware of because they've not been through that experience yet, then I can make a contribution. So for instance, MeVita is the name of the company which helps clients avoid unconscious bias, and I serve on the board, and they've done a tremendous job and survived a really difficult year in the recruitment space. And I feel that if I can help that company be successful, then I'll have played a small part in trying to remove things which we are not responsible for. We're biased because that's the way our brains work, and machines can help us avoid those biases. So I don't try to go out and do dozens of deals, and there's no particular theme. It's more about, can I relate to that founder's passion, and do I buy into their mission? There's a group based in London in the UK called Founders, which is a community of founders who look after each other, help each other out, act as a sounding board. It's a tough game. It's a tough business. So I'm serving on the D&I committee, and I'm learning a lot from other committee members who are much more in the thick of things and in many cases experts. So I feel that in 5 or 10 years, the themes which were in the early days of today, for instance, sustainability as well, will be much better understood. And just like it's worked out for me in the past, if I can be in the right place at the right time, then I'll look a little bit smarter in 5 or 10 years from now. So I'm trying to stumble around and be in the right place at the right time. And it's opportunistic.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I guess me too. One thing I wanted to do is end, because I'm trying to build my own kind of tech for good business, and sort of see what you think about that, and like where you think the problems would be really nice if you're able to add some value, which I'm pretty sure you can. So I did mention earlier, but for the sake of the podcast, so I'm running Syncify, which is a podcasting app to let people listen together and share experiences online, because essentially like relationships are built by sharing experiences and doing things together. And you can do that via like online gaming, and that's great, but like in the rest of the digital world, there's not actually a really intuitive way to actually just sort of spend time with your friends and do things together which you enjoy. So I love learning and listen to podcasts, so I just would love to spend time actually with my friends that also like the things I like, to be able to like learn with them and like have a reason to actually just chat about the same things, but other people are into different things but listen on podcasts, so they can just spend that time being social without really having any time out of their life. It's just sort of and adding a social component to something that's there, which I feel should just like connect people and make the world like a better place on like relationship side of things. But then like I also mentioned the things of like, okay, we'd actually really like to help people with like their unconscious biases and like increased diversity. Like I just feel like this could be like a really good thing, but you think that you're going to do something amazing. What do you think, one, could go wrong? And two, what do you think your advice would be to me around sort of raising investment? Because that's the point where I'm at. Like, I just finished Techstars. We've got like a team. We're paying money. It'll run out soon. We need to like actually convince a bunch of investors to give us money. We've got a product that's now working and it's doing stuff. So trying to scale and things and sort of trying to focus currently on raising investment before we have time to actually look at traction. And it's a lot of things going on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll give you an anecdote for what it's worth, which is, you know, investing can be very lonely because you've got these options and you need to analyze it. You've got to make a decision. It can go horribly wrong. Some of my early investments have gone bust, which is not great financially. And then I feel bad for the team and I try to help them out and help them to bounce back. But what I'm trying to do is invest ethically. And that means you can't just buy an index tracker because you'll have extractive industries and tobacco and firearms in there. So I'm trying to find investments which are what's called ESG, so environmental, social, and governance standards, but then also sort of impact investments. So for instance, being able to have a positive impact on climate change through renewable energy. And for me, what I've actually just done is to set up a little investment club with some friends who have similar motivations, can share ideas, can help each other out. And that would plug really well into what you mentioned, being able to listen to similar things and comment and share ideas. So I think that's a particular example. But the downside is sometimes people just don't care or can't work up the energy. A good friend of mine, Vijay, has started a company which is helping parents with being better parents, supporting their kids emotionally. I've got three kids. As a parent, you always go through. But being able to find the right resource and then being able to connect and have the conversation takes some effort. And the easier one makes it, whether it's a curated content, whether it's the right community, whether it's saying, here's a pain point which you haven't anticipated. But apathy can kill a business. And we see this in a lot in financial services. You can have the whizziest savings app and people will still go down to the pub and spend their money and not save enough. And I think for investors, it's about showing that beachhead of customers or that those early users, people go, I really need this. You're really helping me solve a problem. And then you can build from there. So that's maybe a long answer to your question, but finding those pain points, and there's an old Silicon Valley expression is, I don't want a vitamin, I need a painkiller. And I think that can make the difference.
Definitely. It's sort of just saying that your relationships can be a bit nicer and things sounds a bit more like a vitamin. If it's sort of, we talk about, okay, your relationships are kind of crumbling as you leave university, you haven't actually got time for people or something, maybe this has become more of a painkiller. Or say like long distance relationships with like sort of actual partners and things, that's like a huge painkiller. But are we just an app for couples at that point, which doesn't sound like such a huge market suddenly? And yeah, interesting questions, thanks. And certainly cool that you're doing the whole like club with friends, and if we can help you guys share ideas, I'd love to let you try out the product. That'd be quite fun. Thanks for the tips and such. Just wondering if you should come up with some answers, see what you think about things. As in, so currently we've been like focusing on students as our early traction, because like from the research, there's loads of people that actually are now using like WhatsApp groups, and like I'm in a few book clubs with friends that I didn't even start, like where we are literally just sort of trying to pick a book a month, and it just gives an excuse to like have a phone call each month with my mates and do something together. And so there's been quite a lot of people doing this underground, but it's hard to like exactly like identify who they are and find them, and like they're probably also the people that aren't on social media as well, so like trying to advertise them is a bit harder. Whereas like students, they are all at uni, and so we're just going for like societies where you can actually just find like the head of like a certain community. And like, so we're going with like the entrepreneurial societies where like they are all trying to learn stuff, and it's, we can speak to them because we understand like the content that they want to listen to and like how they'd want to engage around it anyway. And it sort of makes sense because they are struggling to meet up as much, and so there's a bigger pain for them to actually try and fix at the moment right now. Some investors are kind of like, our students are a bit flaky and it's not really ideal starting, but for us it sort of made sense as we can just literally try and call every single student society in England that's entrepreneurial and sort of get them on board. So that started going well. But do you think that's like a sensible strategy, or do you think there's a better target audience that this could be a painkiller for?
Well, sometimes you want to prove a behavior. And so young people is a good place to start in terms of adoption and usage and showing how things work. And then the business might lie somewhere else. So you might find that you can monetize it in other communities, but you've got a pattern of behavior which you understand, then you can optimize your product to make it the best experience possible. So I'm thinking this is tragic, but for instance, if you've got, you know, a medical event in a family and you're desperately trying to learn how to cope with somebody you're looking after, then you want to be able to get up to speed quickly and connect with other people who've been through that experience before, which is not about young people and one social life, but to have a shared learning experience, which has been built on understanding how people use it in a different context, could be a way forward. It's always tricky because there's usually a trade-off between sort of scale and traction versus a narrow kind of like pain point which can be monetized. And if you've got multiple hits at it, then you give yourself a better chance to find, you know, the sweet spot, which will in all likelihood be a blend of different communities.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And yeah, definitely a painkiller for those people who are just trying to learn things super fast. And I mean, my initial thought was like, okay, to people in my area, it's just like running a startup, because, you know, we are trying to learn really fast and you listen to lots of good things relevant to you that you want your co-founders to understand. And it, so I've been listening to stuff and like syncifying with my co-founders and like recording a podcast about it, where we sort of will listen to something that's relevant to us and then actually sort of share the conversation. But it definitely has made us much more aligned and helps us with a lot of the problems that we're trying to be making decisions on. And it's quite frustrating when, let's say, one of you listens to something and then you want to like implement the policy, but the other people don't really understand it. Why? Or like you actually spend the whole meeting trying to explain what the thing is that you learned rather than then like doing the thing. Whereas if you've all like listened to the same thing, you kind of arrive with the shared knowledge and then you kind of just move straight onto the action of how to implement it. So that was another thing I was thinking. But again, where it's like, hey, just getting a whole lot of startups and like maybe some of them listen to podcasts and things, or it was a bit harder to implement than the student side of things.
One more example. This is an idea which I got from my brother Mohit, who is at the University of Peace in Costa Rica. He comes up with a one word New Year's resolution. And so my one word for next year is wellness. And that's to try to better understand things like nutrition, looking after kind of like one's physical and mental health. Again, it's meant to be a big tent. I'm an investor in a company called Heights, which is a brain care company.
Me too.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I met Dan a few years ago. So we gave it to each other, like sort of podcast tips and things. But it's just like when it was kind of just like still like an idea. And yeah, it's been pretty cool what he's done with it.
Yeah, it's awesome. And so they say it right, like people spend like this much money on hair care and like this much on brain care. And I feel like I've learned a lot about hydration and I'm, you know, walking a lot more because the Heights team says I should. And it's a huge area where I know nothing about. And luckily, touch wood, I'm 51. I'm in, you know, reasonable health. And so the amount of time and money and attention I spend on health is minimal. But if something were to happen, how much would I spend to maintain what I have? A huge amount, potentially. So why not take the steps now rather than wait to pay that bill? And so that's what I'm going to try to do and get more educated about wellness and brain care through Heights. So I think that concept is much better understood. We're living much longer lives. We're looking after ourselves better, like physically and mentally. And a lot of that is new science and new learning. And to be able to sort of like turn that into, whether it's a subscription or whether it's a product or whether it's part of one's sort of like lifestyle, I really think that there's value to be uncovered, because most people don't appreciate their health until something happens and then it becomes invaluable.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I was gonna say, and also kind of relationships and things, and you don't really notice the value of them as such, or invest time in making those things happen until like too late. So yeah, and like, well, certainly I think around the whole, like, I really find that the app does help me on the learning side, because if you just listen to a podcast once or you hear something amazing, it goes in, but then you have no reason to discuss it or do anything with the information, and it kind of just sort of gets forgotten. Whereas if you had shared experience with someone and you can talk about it, you get to hear what they thought, and that gives you new perspectives. You then have to say what you think, which sort of just solidifies it and makes you kind of like turn it into a more like real thing in your brain, and like maybe, you know, agree to actually sort of do those things when you're like, oh yeah, I should be doing more walking. If you told someone to that, you're more likely to do it than if you just sort of thought it, but then like something else comes on your agenda.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So we've got a lockdown puppy called Charlie who drags me out every day for a walk, you know. And I keep thinking, I wasn't looking forward to tramping around Clapham Common in my wellies in December, but I'm thinking, hey, this is good for my brain, you know, so enjoying the fresh air. So thanks to Charlie, I'm actually taking some action to work on my next year's New Year resolution.
Cool. It's good to hear. Nice. So did you say you had to run?
I'd better go, yes, but I've got a call coming up, but hopefully you've got enough.
Oh, yeah. Yes, this has been great. Thanks so much. And yeah, it's been so nice speaking to you.
All right. Take care now.
You too.
Great to talk. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you have any questions, please reach out to me through the website at growthmindsetpodcast.com. I do love talking to listeners. You can support us on Patreon or by leaving a review on iTunes or telling a friend about us. But mostly, keep learning and keep growing.